Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. And that's what we're facing, folks. It is a war for our civilization, Judeo-Christian civilization, and we're in the midst of one of the great centers for waging that war on behalf of freedom and the people who love it around the world. And that is the National Religious Broadcasters Convention in Nashville, Tennessee. It is an extraordinary treat to have opposite me a man that I've gotten to know a little bit in recent days and have admired tremendously for a while, but specifically have come to appreciate for what he's doing now for the cause of freedom in so many different ways. His name is Mike Lindell. You have probably seen him. Well, scratch that. You have assuredly seen him. And if you haven't seen him, you've certainly heard him talking about his product, MyPillow, MyPillow.com. Mm. But that's only part of his story. It's a most infecting and deeply moving part of his story. And I had a chance to watch last night as he and Eric Metaxas did a wonderful little pas de deux here at NRB. Mike Lindell, we don't have a whole lot of time to do justice to any part of your fabulous story, and I know mostly people would love to hear the really fantastic part of it, which is sort of how you came to be this unbelievably successful entrepreneur and businessman. I want you to say a word about that, but I really want to talk about what you're doing now, because right. I think in many ways that's the God thing that's really right. important right. to share. Right.
Well, I can give a real quick, I was a crack cocaine addict. And I invented my pillow in 2004, and I lost everything. But all the way up to 2009, I was deeply into crack. Lost a marriage of 20 years, and drug dealers did an intervention on me and trying to get me to quit because I told them someday I would come back and help them. And I quit everything overnight on January 16, 2009. And at that time, I started getting my pillow back piece by piece, and there were a series of miracles all the way up through 14. I had lost everything again. We were 2 days away from going completely under, and I met this gal, Kendra, and she had this amazing relationship with Jesus that I didn't have. I'm going, well, what do you mean? I believe in God. Anyway, she was praying for the company, and we did a couple other commercials then, short form commercials, and they didn't work. And then a person in the company said, well, Mike, you need to get in there. And I said, you know, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do any hard sell. I just want to tell people about the pillow. And I did go in there, and they just exploded. We have 1,600 employees nowadays, 36 million pillows sold. But it's
a God thing, though.
Yeah,
at the end
absolutely.
Of the day,
you
say that so
yeah.
clearly in your life.
It's absolutely a miracle.
So giving back is a big part of what you're doing now.
Absolutely.
And I want you to talk about your foundation and the work that you're engaged in there, but I also want you to talk about, we'll leave some time for some of the outreach that you're making, particularly to younger folks who need to hear this message as much as anyone.
Right. Well, I'm giving back. It's a big. I'm using this platform for God, for Jesus now, to this country. And I ended up meeting the president before when he was just the president-elect. He called me to meet with him, and I told him we both talked about the inner cities, all these amazing things we would do, that could be done. I met with Ben Carson, and he became a friend of mine, and we talked about the inner cities, and he's got this vision centers he's come out with, and we talked about my foundation. Imagine a foundation where 100% of your money goes to the need, and you get to hear back a difference you made in their life. All these needs have been validated, that they're real needs, and there's no overhead. It's paid by myself and other donors. I've got an app I'm working on with the Recovery Network. These guys from Teen Challenge, Don Wilkerson is... Dave Wilkerson's brother that started Team Challenge, and We've got this app where we're going to take the addicts, and you're going to be able to punch in your drug of choice and your age, and then you can, all these stories will come down of people that have made it, and of your age group, of how did they do it? They got through, and they're
so gonna, it's relevant to you.
Absolutely,
it's not some abstraction or some guy you couldn't care less
absolutely.
About.
Absolutely, you
fabulous.
Know, back when I quit my crack, my friend, I first done cocaine with him in 1984, and I could relate to him because he had been clean 3 years, and I had all these questions for him that only he could answer. And the same thing for a 22-year-old drug addict or whatever. He needs to have stories of hope. And we're downloading, you know, a couple hundred thousand of these stories from alumni that have made it through these amazing centers that have gotten freed of these addictions. And then to the millennials out there, they don't buy pills, but they love my story. they come up to me all the time, and they just love this, my story of redemption. They saw the story, my
including the faith piece.
They love it. They all come up and talk about that. That's the number one thing.
Fantastic.
They come up to me. I'm getting involved. I'm going to be speaking at this event called The Pulse in Minneapolis, at right where the Super Bowl was. 66,000 people. It's a free event, and these are all.
Tell us the date.
It's all these millennials. May 18th. I believe it's May 18th,
great.
And it's going to be amazing. You come there.
It's exclusively millennials, or can older folks turn up too?
They can come too,
but you're really focusing on that younger generation.
The Pulse has had these events before, and they're just on fire for Jesus. And they've been down this road. They know how to put these big events on.
Fabulous.
It's going to be amazing. I've really got on board with them. There's going to be another one in Texas in the fall for 250,000.
Now, 250,000. Where are you going to put 250,000 people?
That part
I
don't know.
You're going to take over a city.
I know. But I really want to, you know, the way our country's going, the way, you know, with the way things are going, you got to reach the younger folks.
Absolutely.
And get them, you know. We turned our back on, our nation turned its back on God. That's the second chance we have right now, and we need to use it with everything we can. And I tell people out there, they say, "Well, what can I do?" Just keep praying, you know, keep praying and keep helping out in your space, whatever your platform is, even if it's small,
right?
Whatever that is, use it.
Right. You know? Well, in that regard, I wanted to just say thank you for the interest that you've expressed in this campaign to save persecuted Christians. Because
absolutely.
This isn't just about what's going on here,
right?
Whether we believe in God or whether we don't, or whether we are serving Him adequately or whether we're not.
Right.
This is about something else we're called to do which is to help those who are being, just because they're faithful to Him,
right? Absolutely,
terribly oppressed and brutalized.
Yeah. When you told me about this, I was all in. You know that.
Well, no, I know, and it was very empowering that you got it, and you got it immediately.
Yeah.
You sense that this is in fact part of the larger service that you're called to, Mike.
Yeah, right.
And your story is amazing. I was listening to you and Eric Metaxas talking about it last night, and particularly that bit, and he just riffed beautifully with you on it about, what do you mean? You had three of the top drug dealers in Minneapolis intervening to get you to stop buying their products. I mean, if that isn't a God thing, what
isn't
is?
Isn't that something?
And I know you've got some of them on your payroll now.
Yeah,
working
absolutely.
For
they're
you, which is an even
Christian.
More amazing story.
Well, that, I kept my promise. They told me, they go, Mike, if you know, you made a promise to us you'd come back and help us someday. And to be able to now to do all the stuff I'm doing with the inner cities and go back right where I was, right the place where I used to buy all my drugs. And they're going, you know, and they're here. They see me with the president at the White House. And they're going, wow, you were. And for them, so many of my friends have quit drugs. I mean, they just see the miracles of here's a crack addict, ex-crack addict at the White House, you know, in there. And they just see that had to be God. That's not Mike Lindell.
Well,
you know?
and that's the thing that I really want to just say in closing. Your unwavering credit giving to God for having effected this incredible transformation, not only in your own life, but in that life of the life of so many others you're touching. Be 250,000 millennials, for heaven's sake.
It's going to be amazing.
That's an incredible blessing because, as you said, and we feel it so powerfully here, if those folks to whom we're going to pass this torch don't understand what this country is about, including its Judeo-Christian traditions and values, we're done.
Absolutely.
Let's face it. And it's not just us, and it's not just the persecuted Christians around the world. It's Western civilization, and I think world
Oh, you're absolutely right. And it is possible. It seems like a big task, but with God, all things are possible.
And we will get it done.
He will get it done.
He will, with our help.
with our help, yours especially.
Mike Lindell, thank you so much. MyPillow.com. If you haven't got one, you better get cracking.
For the best night's sleep.
There we go. Unpaid commercial announcement. Mike, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Great to see you. God bless. And for being here at NRB.
God bless you. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. In the halls of the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, I'm very pleased to say we have come across a man whose handiwork I have admired since I was exposed to it the other day. He is John Gruters. He is, well, a filmmaker. And he has just made a remarkable film that is very much relevant to a topic near and dear to my heart. It is about Christians being persecuted for their faith. The title of the film, which is going to be rolling out on the 5th of March, is Tortured for Christ. It's going to be appearing in movie theaters across the country. I'm told that some 50,000 tickets have been sold for this movie, which is pretty extraordinary for an independent film. He has joined us to talk briefly about the story of Tortured for Christ, how you came to make this movie, and the message that you want to impart to those who will be watching it. But first of all, let me just say, I was powerfully moved by what I thought was an extraordinarily high quality and very dramatic treatment of a very difficult subject. So thank you, John.
Well, I really appreciate that, Frank. It has been sort of a cliche, but an effort of love to do this project. The story is so legitimate. When you get to tell a story of a guy like Richard Wurmbrand and Sabina Wurmbrand, who I never met, they died in the year 2001. But your colleague, Steve Cleary, knew them very well. And he was an invaluable resource. And so I've only got to know them through their writings and through their ministry.
Tell us the story, just quickly, because they are iconic figures in this movement of saving the persecuted Christians. But what was his story?
Richard Wurmbrand was a Lutheran pastor in Romania, and he was an atheistic Jew as a young man. He came to Christ in his 20s, and God put in his heart, according to him, a desire to reach, of all people, the Nazis and the communists. But he lived in Romania.
Hard targets, we
would call
them.
Which didn't have Nazis or communists until the Nazis invaded their country. And Richard said, oh, God's given me an opportunity. And the Nazis beat him and threw him in prison. And then World War II ended, and Romania had to choose sides between two evils. They had no choice. It's a rock and a hard place. So they chose the Nazis, who then lost, which means the Romanians were given their country as the spoils of war. So in 1944,
to the communists,
a million communist soldiers just poured over the border and just took over the place. I mean, they had total occupation, and that was the way it was. Atheism was not just sort of a sidelight. It was the official state religion, and they were aggressive. They were as aggressively anti-Christian as ISIS is today. And Richard and some of his fellow Christians got completely caught into that. If they wouldn't just cooperate with the communists and spy and cattle on their congregations, it's an impossible situation.
This is a practice that's still very much with us today in places like China. You have the official church.
Exactly.
The church of the regime, in that case, Nicolae Ceaușescu's, I guess,
exactly.
In due course, horrific as it was.
Well, Ceaușescu starting in the early 60s, but Richard was taken from the streets in 1948.
Earlier, right.
So February 29th of 1948, ironically, which would be today if it was leap year today. Today's March 1st as we're speaking. This is actually the very day, if this were the leap year, that Richard was taken. He ended up spending 8 years that first time in these communist prisons. And Richard says to be in a communist prison is to be tortured. They weren't just locked up. They were brutally, physically, aggressively, with pure evil behind it, re-educated to try to deny their faith and a pledge to the party. He was released for about a year and a half and was rearrested and spent another. So it was in all over 14 years for him. And it was a miracle he didn't die, and it was a miracle he was released.
How was he released? How did that come about?
Now, was he ransomed? In the early 60s when Khrushchev was in power, and there was a point where they, at that point, you were past Stalin, and they had a little bit of an amnesty moment, and he was released. But they realized if he stayed in Romania, he wouldn't have lasted on the streets long. And so, I think it was the Norwegians or the Swedes, one of those two groups raised $10,000 to get them a passport out of the country, which was five times the official going rate. So people poured their lives into helping them. And when Richard came to America, he had to change his mission. He could no longer be about reaching the communists for Christ. He realized now he had to be a voice for those who were still in prison, the brothers and sisters that he had seen. And so he wrote Tortured for Christ, published it in 1967. And until that book came out, as far as I know, the world hadn't heard stories about the communist prisons.
Right.
You know, it took a long time to hear about Auschwitz. I mean, those things weren't on the news. But Richard's book shocked people. This was our ally,
right,
and this is now our enemy in the Cold War. And his book sold a bestseller. He was invited to speak before the U.S. Senate subcommittee. They weren't sure if they believed his stories. They were so fantastical. So he took his shirt off in the middle of the subcommittee meeting. He stripped. And he had 18 puncture wounds in his torso. He earned the right to be heard in every way a person can earn the right to be heard. He took the suffering, and he didn't give in to hatred. And he loves them.
And that, by the way, is one of the things that you capture so brilliantly. Mm. I was talking earlier during our stay here with Jim Dow.
Yeah, Jim.
Who's, I know, been involved in this project as well. And
yes,
he recounted that story. But just tell us about that one vignette where he's talking with his torturer.
Oh, I think I know. Yeah, Richard was in isolation for 2.5 years, almost 3 years. Solitary confinement. We shot this, by the way, in some of the real prisons where
did
he was
really?
Held. They're standing. And, I mean, there is no more powerful set, even for the sake of the actors to be in character, than to be where the walls are still echoing with a lot of pain. So we were filming in an isolated chamber. So we filmed a couple of days where the guard would come down. It was forbidden to pray. It was forbidden to speak. And during the day, it was forbidden to sit. You have to stand all day until 10 o'clock at night when they would open your bench. Well, Richard would pray. And they would haul him out, and they would beat the tar out of him, and they'd throw him back in there bloody. And the next day they'd come by, and they'd peek in the little hole in the door. They would have these small little peepholes, and there's Richard, not hiding it, not pretending to stand, but, I mean, on his knees in fervent prayer to the Lord, a real engagement and encounter with God. Haul him out again, beat the daylights out of him, bring him back. We established that this is going on. Finally, the guy comes back for the third time, and he's like, he's exasperated. He says, what are you doing praying to this imaginary God? Don't you know, your wife is in prison, your son is an orphan, your life is over, everybody thinks you're dead. I mean, what do you possibly have to pray for? And Richard looks at him and he says, I was praying for you, which he was. How do you respond to that? Even evil, even cruelty can be shattered by love. And that happened in Richard's case, and some of his prison guards were so shattered by his love that they actually prayed to become Christians, and they tried to hide it, and many times they were found out because their whole countenance had changed. So it's if he can do that there, it's just a message to me how quickly I turn on my foes and want to squash them instead of pray for them. It's kind of hard to miss that message.
Yeah. It was one of those most riveting of cinematic moments, I think, in my life. Mm. And I think you captured it brilliantly. John Gruters is our guest. He has just made a fabulous film, Tortured for Christ. How will people be able to see this film past the rollout on the 5th of March, when it will be screening in special release?
Well, the rollout is 5th of March, which is coming up very quickly. And if they go to torturedforchrist.com, that's the way they're selling movie tickets. That's the way this distributor decided to do it. So if you happen to hear this before that, go on there. You'll see a theater near you, and you can see it one night only, Monday night. If enough people see it, they do what they call encore performances, and I'm praying that we will get encore performances. And then beyond that, I would just go to torturedforchrist.com and see what the distributors decide. It's going to be released. I'm going back to Romania next week to start working on a 6-part curriculum that will accompany the movie. I'm really excited. And I'm especially excited. I'm going to go back next week, and we're going to have a premiere in Bucharest for all the actors, all the crew who were outstanding. Yeah, I just can't say enough about the people. I cannot wait to show them the fruits of their work.
Good. Well, I hope to show it to as many people in this country as well. John Gruters, thank you for joining us today. Thank you for being here at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention and for spending some time with us on behalf of, well, the same mission you're about, which is saving persecuted Christians. God bless you.
Amen.
We'll talk with you again soon.
Bless you,
I hope.
Guys.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are visiting with interesting people who are coming our way as we sit along part of the exhibition hall of the National Religious Broadcasters in Nashville, Tennessee, where we're participating, I'm very proud to say, as a participant and sponsor of this program, of the Religious Broadcasters in America, who do such an incredibly important job. We're visiting at the moment with one of those very interesting people, Raul Bulos. He is an expatriate Egyptian, now an American citizen, who came to the United States in 1986. His specialty is translation, and he is also doing mediation and is helping to communicate to people back in his native land information about freedom, and in particular the opportunities that this country affords those who yearn to enjoy it, who, and they're lucky, make their way here as Raul has done. We're visiting with him in the context of two important topics, as I see it. One is the plight of people like himself, a Coptic Christian in Egypt, and for that matter, Christians elsewhere in the Middle East and around the world, and also about the phenomenon of Sharia supremacism, which is one of the factors that is, I'm thinking, making the lives of so many Christians very difficult at the moment, and has some ominous implications for us here as well. Raul Bulos, it's good to have you with us. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Let me ask you to begin. As we were talking before we began recording, you made a very important point. It's not uncommon among people who have come here to enjoy freedom and live the American dream.
Yes.
But I find that they generally appreciate this country in a way that most of us who take it for granted don't. Talk a little bit about your experiences in that regard, if you would.
Definitely. Thank you so much. As a matter of fact, it is the freedom we enjoy here to go to church every Sunday morning, for instance, and to worship freely. And many times we take it for granted. And we just, I am tired today. I'm not going to go to church, or I will go do it online. But we need to remember there are Christians in globally, in Middle East, and you think China, you think North Korea, and they worship, and they have to do it underground, and they don't have that freedom we have here. And so once we come to this country, we do appreciate so much the freedom we have here to be able to worship and to sing and shout hallelujah anywhere. That is
pray so and write what you wish and
and
even proselytize, which is not, of course, something that is looked upon with favor back in places like Egypt, and to the extent that there is sadly ongoing persecution of Christians in Egypt.
Yes.
Much of this seems to be at the hands of the Muslim Brotherhood and other, well, I call them Sharia supremacists.
Right.
But there is some reason to be concerned about the government of President el-Sisi. My experience has been that Copts in Egypt are rather more favorably disposed towards el-Sisi than are Copts in the diaspora, but I can't quite tell whether that's just because they're under his thumb and, you know, he's the only thing that stands between them and even worse persecution, at, for example, the tender mercies of the Muslim Brotherhood. Talk about your views on that.
First of all, I would like to mention the fact that there is between 10% or 12% of the population of in Egypt are Christians. Many times, as soon as I say I'm from Egypt, they say, oh, you are a Muslim. I say, no. Okay, well, you've been a Muslim and you converted to Christianity. I say, no, that is also not true. As a matter of fact, I was born in a Christian home, and the Christianity was in Egypt way before Islam. And that is so simple. When we read the book of Acts, we know that it's the whole Middle East originally Christian before Islam came, seven centuries after Christ. And all that to say that, and now you see majority of those countries are Muslims and the minorities are Christians. So I belong to that Christian minority. I'm so proud to belong to the Coptic Church and the Evangelical Coptic Church in Egypt. But you mentioned something so important about it, President Sisi, and generally speaking, we do appreciate him. In a sense, he is one of the, I would say, the best so far president. Never before any president of Egypt will go during Christmas time to celebrate Christmas in the church, in the big church, and it is in TV, in state TV. In that sense, he's doing great. Nobody else before him. I still remember President Nasser and President Sadat, the one who signed the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, and then Mubarak never did that. So Sisi was really, in that sense, is the best. Yet, persecution is happening. Persecution is happening. And it's very interesting.
But is it at the hands of the government, Rauf, or is it, despite the efforts of the government to prevent it from happening, at the hands of jihadis?
As a matter of fact, mainly in the hand of the Muslim Brotherhood. There is another group called the Salafi. You heard that name on the news. And very interesting to point the fact that Muslim Brotherhood started in Egypt. And President Nasser was against them, and Sadat was against them. But also, the government, or specifically the secret police and so on, they turn the other...
blind eye.
Blind eye, thank you. And they just like, oh, as if nothing happened. And sometimes they protect the persecutors against the persecuted Christians. And because they, Muslim Brotherhood today is infiltrated all the Egyptian army and the police, and so it is really hard.
And the educational system too, right?
Everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
They are everywhere.
Let me turn very quickly, and we don't have a whole lot of time, I'm afraid, but I do want to draw upon your experience with this phenomenon. Again, I call it Sharia supremacism. As to whether we should be concerned about the Muslim Brotherhood in this country and its efforts to dominate the Muslim community and insist on accommodations to it, including as a separate parallel society. For example, we were discussing off air this phenomenon of female genital mutilation, which I think is one of the most barbaric, one of many barbaric manifestations of Sharia supremacism. It's happening in our country. By some estimates, 500,000 women and girls are already subjected to it or will be. How serious a problem is this in your adopted America?
100% true, what you mentioned. And it is in America. And to point to the fact that during the time of Obama administration, you find that the Muslim Brotherhood, they are here and they made their way. And I can name CARE and Islamic Student
Muslim Students Association.
Muslim Students, yeah. You name
Islamic
them.
Islamic Society of North America, yes, the Islamic Circle of North America, and on.
Thank you. The list is so long. So they are here, and the goal to apply Sharia law. Once we set Sharia law, that will go to all what you mentioned is modulation, and they applying that here, and they try to start, and they have a strategy.
We'll continue with Rauf Bulos, a translator by training, but a courageous man who is helping to spread the word about what's happening in his native land of Egypt and what is happening in ours. More with him momentarily.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation with Rauf Bulos. He is a man who has turned up here visiting with us at our booth at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention. We're talking about what is happening in our country, as well as his own native land of Egypt and elsewhere, that is a threat, not just to Christianity or to its followers, or for that matter, to the free world, but also very specifically to America and the freedom that he has been able to enjoy here as a naturalized American citizen. And as we broke, Rauf, you were talking about the strategy of these Sharia supremacists in America. Develop that thought, if you would.
They start basically Muslim Brotherhood. They made their way to the highest level and the Obama administration. And basically, they start to say, well, we will have a community. And you go to Bridgeview, Illinois, and you find a huge mosque, and it has Islamic Center to teach Arabic language, and it has a clinic, it is Islamic clinic. And then they will say, well, we will have a court room to apply divorce and apply Sharia law. So it is step by step, they are building a country within the country.
Parallel system.
Exactly right.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the places which we've found as we've been trying to learn about this practice of female genital mutilation in the United States is that there is, as you say, a clinic, a parallel medical society developing now.
Right.
In which these young girls, some as young as 7 years old, are being mutilated, permanently disfigured in ways that will cause them health as well as psychological problems all their lives.
They may die sometimes.
In some cases, they actually die. But it's only really when they get into that kind of difficulty that they wind up in the American medical system's emergency rooms.
Right.
And they try to patch them up. But aside from that, oftentimes these young girls or women are never seen by American doctors. And therefore, it's going on as a kind of underground or parallel and horrific practice.
Yes.
And I just wonder, as you look at the Brotherhood, this is obviously not an accident. This is something that we've actually learned about in a book. I'm not sure whether you're familiar with it. There was a Muslim Brotherhood leader by the name of Muhammad Akram.
Oh, yes.
Who back in 1991 wrote a memorandum for the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood back in Egypt, describing how the brothers had been able to progress in the first roughly 25 years of their operations in the United States. And you mentioned some of the groups that they'd set up, but this describes something called civilization jihad as a technique for basically subverting this country from within through these parallel systems and penetration of our institutions and so on. Do you see this in the Arab community of which you are a part, if not Muslim, certainly of a part?
Definitely. And the illustration I like to give is water. When you put the water in a cup, it takes the shape of
the cup.
You put it in a different vessel, and it takes the shape. And that is in Quran, that is in Islam, that is the essence there, that follow the rules until as long as you are a minority. Once you grow, then you apply this Sharia and you go.
You dominate.
Exactly.
Everyone else submits.
Exactly.
And you know what's fascinating to me, and again, our guest is Raouf Boulos. He's a translator and a communicator back to the Arab world, and I will talk more about that piece in a moment. But just very quickly, a woman who, as you say, penetrated the highest levels of the United States government, I believe, bringing with her the Muslim Brotherhood agenda, is a longtime aide to Hillary Clinton by the name of Houma Abedin.
Yes.
And as you may know, Ruth, the Abedin family's business, basically,
yes,
which they were put into by the Muslim Brotherhood,
yes,
was something called the Institute for Muslim Minority Affairs. And to your point, it was all about, it is still all about, how you maintain a separate system that is right. dominated by the Sharia supremacists
right.
while you beaver away at undermining the majority society
true.
To the point where you can take it over.
Yes.
And I,
yes.
I just am struck by how yes. really outrageous it is that this was not something that was stopped.
Yes.
Given what we know, among other things, from right. Muhammad Akram's book, which we learned of in 2004.
Yes, we learned that from our experience. That is how it happened back in Egypt, again, because we were the majority in a certain point of time during the first century, and how step by step they were taking over until they became majority, and then now we are second-class citizens, third-class citizens.
Dimmies.
Exactly right. That is the right term.
Yeah.
Demons.
Well, that's the term they use for it. So one of the things I know you're doing, Raouf Boulos, is you're transmitting information back to Egypt and other parts of the Middle East
right.
about Jesus and
yes.
your faith.
Yes.
Would you talk a little bit about that and what the purpose is, as you see it?
My family and I have been in Egypt more than five times. And when I say my family, I'm talking my wife and children here in the States, because I have still my siblings all in Cairo, Egypt. And last November, my son and I were in Egypt. And the picture there, you see families, they lose their daughters because they've been kidnapped and taken by Muslim fundamentalists and to Islamization, that is a key word.
Forced into marriage or, in
exactly.
some cases, just
right.
slavery, I guess.
Huh? Right, right. And it is one-way street. Once you've been Muslim, you cannot be back to Christianity.
Right.
That is by law. There also those who convert from Islam to Christianity, there are some, by God's grace, and they face all kind of persecution, and this penalty is right there. And it is very interesting to show the love of Christ, because Christ never imposed himself in anyone. And I have that story very quickly, how that person I was sharing with him, Jesus, and he had the Bible and start reading, and then he came to the point where Jesus said to the disciples, if you want to continue follow me, it is up to you, otherwise that is fine. And that guy became Christian at that point. I said, help me understand, why is that? And by the way, that is in Book of John chapter 6 verse 66, has nothing to do with 666, by the way. And he said, Muhammad in Quran said, if you recant your faith, you are dead. But Jesus said, it is up to you. I'm not going to impose myself
free
on
will.
You. That is free will.
A central tenet of Christianity
he
and
said,
Western civilization.
That is the master. I will follow him the rest of my life. And he accepted Christ as Savior, right? And this is fun. So
a wonderful story. We have to leave it at that. Thank you, Ralph. Thank you so much for your time
Thank
and for
you.
What you're doing to help clarify
Thank
for
you.
Both audiences here and in the Middle East.
My pleasure.
The truth. Ralph Bulos, I know you will keep up the good work. Come back to us, I hope, in the near future. And I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.